Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. He's automotive royalty in Japan, but today the CEO of Toyota faces a congressional grilling. 53-year-old Akio Toyoda has been groomed since birth to take over the company his grandfather founded. Today he's expected to apologize to the American public and offer solutions in the wake of an 8 million car worldwide recall. Also today, U.S. transportation officials will be asked where they lax in investigating Toyota. And this all comes after yesterday's testimony, during which Toyota's president of U.S. operations, James Lentz, made the stunning admission that Toyota still can't figure out what happened in 70% of the cases of sudden acceleration. Paul Eisenstein is publisher of the DetroitBureau.com. Paul, first of all, have you ever seen anything like this in the 30 years you've been covering this?
I've got to tell you that I am at a loss for words when I'm asked that. I sat there chattering yesterday. I couldn't find a way to describe this. I have never seen a meltdown of a manufacturer so quickly, though, of course, we've seen some pretty serious disasters over the past with Ralph Nader and GM.
The Pinto.
Ford, Firestone.
Pinto. Yeah, that caught on fire. Mm-hmm.
Exactly.
Right. Well, today, Transportation Secretary Ray LaHood was the first to address lawmakers. They wanted a simple answer to a simple question. Does LaHood believe that Toyotas are safe to drive? Here's this exchange with Democrat Elijah Cummings of Maryland. Let's listen.
Well, let me answer you very directly, Mr.
Sure.
Cummings.
Thank you.
For those cars that are listed on our website, dot.gov, for recall, to go back, those are not safe. We've determined they're not safe.
All right.
We believe that we need to look at the electronics in these cars because people have told us they believe there's an issue, and we're going to do that.
Paul Eisenstein, I just want to ask you first. At times, these exchanges got very animated. LaHood got very animated. They got very personal with lawmakers saying to him, look, we've known you for a long time. And what's going on here politically?
Well, there's a lot of issues coming up right now. Of course, there is the issue of U.S. versus Japanese relationships. There is the issue of a sharply divided Congress, talking to an administrator that represents this current Democratic administration. But then it gets more complicated, by the way, because Ray LaHood is a Republican by background, and many of the decisions, including one in which Toyota was allowed to escape a major recall, came when George Bush was president, and many government bodies had the policy of working very closely, being very friendly with industry. So there's a lot of issues here that could tar a lot of folks going forward.
Right. So they're sort of walking on a tightrope in many ways. Well, and then there's the very, very personal. Yesterday, Congress heard tearful testimony from that Tennessee woman, Rhonda Smith, mm-hmm. who talked about how she thought she was going to die. Her Lexus sped up to 100 miles an hour. She couldn't stop it. Today, lawmakers are going to hear from relatives who lost four loved ones in that horrible San Diego crash last August, when Mark Saylor and three of his family members died when his rented Lexus took off 125 miles an hour. He made that harrowing 9/11 call in which he said, we're approaching an intersection. Hold on. Pray. Do you think we're going to be hearing that 911 call in testimony?
We may very well hear that. This is a sort of politicized environment where there is going to be a lot of grandstanding and there's going to be a lot of finger pointing, and I can't think of anything that will get the point across if people want to make it uncomfortable for Mr. Toyota. Remember, in his prepared testimonies, he has been apologizing. And he is in a weird position right now where he has to defend the company, say, we know what we've done, we know what we need to do, and we're moving forward, but we are sorry. Well, as evidence keeps coming out, it appears less and less likely that they do know exactly what's going on. You mentioned earlier the fact that they may have only been able to address 30% of the unintended acceleration complaints with the two recalls of over 8 million vehicles so far. This, after repeatedly telling us they knew exactly what was going on, they knew exactly what to do, they're confident that this issue was taken care of.
And this comes as Dave Gilbert of Southern Illinois University yesterday said he conducted a test and he proves that electrical problems are to blame. So as you said, you now have Toyota's James Lentz saying yesterday they don't know. So that has to be that circle has to be squared somehow. Paul Eisenstein, publisher of the DetroitBureau.com, with the latest on today's hearings into safety problems with Toyota. Paul, thanks as always.
Pleasure to be with you.
Well, we're also getting more details today about tomorrow's healthcare summit. It will have four themes: controlling costs, changing insurance industry practices, reducing the deficit, and expanding healthcare coverage. But the sessions, we learn, will also take place around a big square table, no podiums for the president. And there will be a buffet lunch, perhaps yet another attempt to level the playing field. Well, let's set that big table for tomorrow's summit with David Leonhardt. He writes the Economic Scene column for the New York Times. And David, you are a guy comfortable with two competing ideas because you write today, yes, this summit will be mostly for show, a televised debate, but yes, it still matters. Why does it matter?
Well, it matters because politics matters and appearances matter. And we've seen politics affect this process a number of times already. We saw the town hall meeting eruptions over the summer affect it. We saw Obama's speech to Congress in September affect it. And obviously we saw the Senate election in Massachusetts affect it, even though the Democrats still have more than enough votes to pass this plan if all the Democrats were on board. Politics matters. The Republicans want to use it to remind people of the arguments they've been making all along and which have been working fairly well, that this is a big government takeover of health care, that polls show that people are uncomfortable with this bill. And Obama and the Democrats want to use it to not have it just be a referendum on this bill, but to point out that many of the Republican ideas are more talking points than anything, that when the CBO has scored them, they don't stand up to scrutiny. And so I think those are the kinds of things we're going to see, and we'll see if it affects the debate the way some of the other things have so far this year.
Well, and you're right that there's plenty of room for compromise. So let's take a look at this. And I'm going to broad brush some of the things we know are already in the president's plan. First of all, he's proposing that to help pay for it, everyone be required to buy some insurance or pay a penalty. Employers who don't offer coverage, who have over 50 employees, would pay a sort of graded penalty. Insurers won't be allowed to deny coverage based on pre-existing conditions and will be required to keep children on parents' plans up to age 26. He's also asking for subsidies for the uninsured and small businesses to help them buy insurance. No public option. And then let's get to those conservative ideas that you say are worth looking at. Like what?
Well, I think there are a few quite interesting ideas. One is having Medicare include more competitive bidding than it now does. There are certain aspects of Medicare, these medical devices that you would buy and have in your home, walkers, some beds, all sorts of things. A lot of these things are paid for based on a fee schedule set by Congress. And you'll be shocked to hear that industry lobbyists are able to affect that fee schedule. And so essentially we, the taxpayers, pay significantly more for a lot of these Medicare items than we should have to and we would on an open market. And so if you can create more competitive bidding in Medicare, you should be able to lower costs. The industry always says, oh goodness, people will be hurt by this. But that's what industries always say when their profits are at risk, right? They don't say our profits are at risk. They say you, our customers, are going to be hurt. So I think that's one interesting idea.
Well, and you also address another that Republicans are in favor of, and this is malpractice reform. You suggest it should be something like a health court.
Yeah, I think the health court idea is intriguing. Right now, the malpractice process is extremely variable. Doctors talk about all of the uncertainty in the process, that it can go on for years, that in two very similar cases, in one, a jury might throw out the case, and in another, it might award millions and millions of dollars, and they stretch on for years. These are extremely complicated topics in many cases. And so there is quite a good argument, I think, that if we had a more specialized system for these courts, and we have more specialized courts for all sorts of things in our economy, that it might work a little bit better because these courts could build up a base of knowledge. And the Republican argument is if you did that, you'd reduce some of the defense of medicine going on there. I think there is something to that, although I think the defense of medicine argument is vastly exaggerated in many times. It is not the main problem in our healthcare system, as economists have demonstrated again and again. The caveat is the malpractice system does serve an important function. It puts pressure on doctors not to make mistakes. That is not nothing. And so you would have to make sure that you wouldn't have the American Medical Association be able to capture those health courts and make them too defendant-friendly, and that you would see a real effort on the part of the medical sector to reduce errors. One of the reasons we have malpractice suits is that we have far too many medical errors in this country.
And right now, Newt Gingrich and others are saying that one of the reasons that doctors are doing so many procedures is that they're afraid of being sued if they don't do them. So this will also help them save money that way by not having unnecessary care. In that same vein, many Republicans are also proposing changing the way health care providers are paid from a fee-based system to a different one. Just touch on that, would you?
Yeah, it's a great idea. Newt Gingrich and Bill Frist both called for it recently on the op-ed page of the New York Times. The problem is that Democrats have had a fair number of ideas for doing precisely that, ideas that are accepted by health economists across the spectrum. And Republicans in Congress have opposed those ideas, and they've described them as efforts to cut Medicare and hurt the quality of care of seniors. And so Gingrich and Frist are absolutely right that these are good ideas. They are also right that the bills don't go far enough on this. But what they fail to mention is that the Republicans in Congress have prevented them from going further and have even criticized them for going as far as they do.
David Leonhardt, how much are employer-based plans going to change? This is a huge fear when you listen around. The move to treat employer-offered insurance as income with taxes and rebate proposals. Compare and contrast.
Yeah. Well, my answer to that question is the employer system isn't going to change nearly enough. But I understand that's not the way a lot of people feel.
Conservative columnist David Brooks feels the same way. These proposals aren't being enacted till 2018.
That's right. And that's because they have essentially no support among Republicans to tax benefits, again, because of the politics here. John McCain called for this in the campaign. And they have no support among liberals, or very little support, because unions don't like them. Let's take a step back and ask ourselves, what is the first problem with our healthcare system? I would argue the first problem is that we spend massively more than any country in the world, and we don't get better results. I'm not saying we have a horrible healthcare system, but I'm saying we have one that is massively inefficient. I mean, we spend twice as much on healthcare per person as a lot of other countries, and it's not even clear that we get better results. And so why might that be? There are a lot of reasons. One of the reasons, though, is that we have this subsidy for health insurance. We tax income, but we don't tax health insurance. What that effectively is a subsidy, a government subsidy, a taxpayer subsidy for wasteful health care, right? It's money going into the health care system that isn't even paying for care that makes people healthier.
Well, David Leonhardt, hold that thought. David Leonhardt of the New York Times has been taking us through topics bound to come up at tomorrow's healthcare summit. We were just on the move to treat employer-based healthcare as income and tax it, something David is in favor of. He says, you know, it would give us the care equal to other countries. But many Republicans are in favor as well. They're calling for things like rebates to make up for that tax. We're going to hear more after a break. But before we take that break, here's some other news about tomorrow's summit. One of the most charged items has been abortion. Now, Democratic Representative Bart Stupak of Michigan says the language in the president's proposal departs from current law and allows public funding of abortion. Democrats say no taxpayer funds would pay for abortions. No health plan would be required to offer coverage for the procedure. And when plans do cover abortion, people can't use public funds, as we said. They have to pay separately with private premium payments. That's sure to be on the table tomorrow as well. Back in a minute with more Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back, and we're talking about healthcare reform and what might emerge from President Obama's day-long healthcare summit with congressional Democrats and Republicans tomorrow. New York Times columnist David Leonhardt was just telling us before the break about one of the president's proposals, taxing employer-provided health insurance as income. David, how would this be done?
So one of the suggestions is get rid of that artificial difference in which your income, which you use to pay for your food and your computer and your car, is taxed, but your health insurance is not taxed. Mm-hmm. It seems like a great deal. Oh, wait a second. My health insurance isn't taxed. That's a great deal. But what it does is it forces your income tax rates higher than they would otherwise have to be. And it creates this perverse incentive to have more health care than we actually need. It's one of the reasons we're spending so much. And so there is this nice proposal to begin taxing the very most expensive plans, which should divert money that is now going to healthcare that isn't necessarily making people healthier into people's incomes.
But some Republicans are suggesting that there be this tax across the board on these high-end healthcare plans, but then people also get rebates.
Yeah, I mean, there are a lot of different ideas out there for it, and organized labor is incredibly fearful of this. Their fear comes honestly. I think they're wrong about it. I think if you look at the last 20 years, one of the reasons that income growth was so bad in the last decade was that health costs grew so rapidly. And so I actually think removing some of this tax advantage, removing some of this subsidy for health care and wasteful health care would end up helping people in the long run. But because there's this huge opposition to it and because it doesn't poll that well, that's why in the president's proposal they postponed it to 2018, because basically there's not a huge amount of support for it in Congress.
Well, you know, if you listen around, there's, as you said, a lot of employees are fearful of it as well. But let me ask you a question I've heard. Let's say I have a good health plan. Now it's going to be taxed. What's to stop me from dropping that coverage and paying the much smaller penalty that I'll have to pay now because I won't be covered? Then, when and if I have a catastrophic illness and need coverage, I go back and insurers have to take me.
Well, so what should stop that is some kind of regulation of the market so that you don't have people going to insurers just when they're sick. But I like that example a lot, actually. It is in part highlights what this tax should do. Right now, we get just a couple of options from our employer, right? We don't have the ability to go out and shop for this in the marketplace. Wouldn't it be great if we could choose between a more expensive plan and a less expensive plan? You can see, well, wait a second. Is it really true that that more expensive plan provides me better health care? My suspicion is the answer is no. When economists have done research on this, what they've found is that people with decent health care benefits are much healthier than people with no insurance or really paltry benefits. But people with these Cadillac plans are not healthier and do not get better health care than people who have really good insurance. Instead, what these Cadillac plans seem to do is subsidize a fair amount of wasteful care.
So you're saying that the effect might be that somebody might want to drop that expensive plan, but with these other proposals on the table, like insurance exchanges, people might have a bigger menu to choose from than that expensive plan.
That's exactly right. And we have to ask ourselves, look, do we feel that healthcare costs in this country are too high? I think we clearly do feel that way, and I think we're clearly right to feel that way. And the question is, can we find a way to do it that doesn't damage health? I don't know the answer is yes, but I'm hopeful that it is.
Well, we started by saying that you think the answer is that it will have to do with how many compromises can come after tomorrow's meeting. You suggest that there are some that can be had, but you also say if not, there might be a much smaller bill. What do you see in that small bill?
Well, unfortunately, as much as I think there are really good compromises out there to be had, because of the politics, I don't think they will be had.
And I want to, in case anyone missed the beginning, I want to say you mean on the part of both parties.
I mean much more on the part of Republicans.
Okay.
I think the Democrats would be willing to move this bill to the right in order to pass a sweeping bill that covered many more people. That is in their interests.
Tort reform and things like that?
Yes. Yeah. I think if the Democrats passed a bill that covered a lot of people and it was bipartisan, most of the credit would go to the Democrats. I think the way the politics are lining up is the Republicans have decided that a compromise is not in their interests. That's why you saw them moving the goalposts over the course of the summer. There's also a philosophical thing here. Some number of Republicans in Congress believe that it's just not the government's job to help people get health insurance. And so that, for them, argues against a big grand compromise, even though I think it would be relatively easy to imagine intellectually a big compromise that includes both the Obama stuff and some of these more conservative ideas I've been talking about. So if that's not going to happen on a bipartisan basis in the votes, what could happen? You could do something much smaller. You could, for example, cover young adults who now go off their parents' plan. You can make it easier for them to stay on their parents' plan.
The second biggest thing that I hear is the math doesn't work for me. How does this get paid for? Do you see the math working? In other words, if just one small piece. President Obama is saying everyone will be required to buy some form of insurance, will be penalized if they don't, and that will help pay for it.
I think the Congressional Budget Office is the best estimate we have. I am not positive they are right. Right now, the Congressional Budget Office says these bills are paid for, and they're paid for by cutting subsidies to private insurers that use Medicare. They're paid for by other changes to Medicare that effectively try to get rid of some of the wasteful care I talked about. There's no guarantee they wouldn't also get rid of some other kinds of care. They are paid for in part by taxes on high-income households. And so I think that we have to assume that, in fact, they really are paid for, while also acknowledging that, in the end, they may not be as good as advertised, or they may be better than advertised.
Hmm. On that note, David Leonhard of The New York Times helping us set the very big square table around which lawmakers will sit tomorrow to debate health care in the President Obama summit. David, thanks as always.
Thanks. It's always a pleasure.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now.
There's right and there's wrong. You got to do one or the other. You do the one and you're living. You do the other and you may be walking around, but you're dead as a beaver hat.
That's John Wayne in the 1960 movie The Alamo. And now his kind of cowboy ethic may become law in Wyoming, where legislators have introduced a bill based on the code of the Wild West. Well, Brent Hathaway already uses it to teach finance. He grew up in the Rocky Mountain West, worked in the corporate world, and he's now dean of the College of Business at the University of Wyoming in Laramie. Professor Hathaway, tell us more about this so-called cowboy code. I understand you have it taped above your desk.
I do. It's prominently displayed. I think it's a good reminder for me, the students in the college, and also the business community about what we should aspire to and how we should behave.
Read it off for us.
Absolutely. There's 10 of them in the code. 1, live each day with courage. 2, take pride in your work. 3, always finish what you start. 4, do what has to be done. 5, be tough but fair. 6, when you make a promise, keep it. 7, ride for the brand. 8, talk less, say more. 9, remember that some things are not for sale. And 10, know where to draw the line.
Well, it sounds pretty impressive. There's one that I have a question about, ride for the brand?
Yes. Riding for the brand means that there are often times when you'll have a conflict between your own personal agenda or schedule and what needs to be done for the organization. You can call that work ethic. You can also talk about our role of educating young people and preparing them for the business sector. That's what we do at the University of Wyoming.
So you got to side with the brand, as in the branded cow or, you know, whatever it is. You've got to side with the brand, the organization. Well, interestingly, this code is new. It's based on a book written in 2004 by a Wall Street investor, James Owen. He's from Texas. Now, that book's made into a film. You use it teaching at the University of Wyoming there. Let's just listen to an excerpt from The Code of the West, Alive and Well in Wyoming.
Growing up in Wyoming, when you made a promise, you had to keep it.
People believe in what they're working for. They love what they do, and therefore they strive to be the best at it.
88 Incorporated.
The film goes on, but as I said, a Wall Street investor wrote the book it's based on, The Code of the West. Should we be taking cues from a Wall Street investor now, Brent?
Well, there's clearly been all kinds of things that have caused us concern, not just from the private industry, but from public officials, sports heroes. And so attempting to build a code around how we should behave, not only in the Rocky Mountain region, but in the business world at large, I think is very appropriate.
Well, I'm just thinking the ride for the brand in particular, we learn of so many Wall Street people who went along with what they knew wasn't right. I mean, I'm wondering if you also teach your students sometimes question the brand.
Well, clearly, the first code is live each day with courage. Courage in yourself and challenging the organization that you work with about what's right and what's wrong.
Yeah. Well, if this does become law in Wyoming, it's largely symbolic. It won't replace any civil law or include any criminal penalties if someone doesn't start every day with courage. But how do you see it impact your students?
You know, I think for many of our students, this fits with their upbringing. This fits with who they are, and it resonates well. For some, it's something that they can aspire to. And it's simple, you know, 10 simple statements that are principles that we can live by. When I think about why people come to recruit our students at the University of Wyoming, I ask what qualities they find attractive, and they ultimately say it boils down to work ethic, integrity, and character. And so that's something we work hard to reinforce for our students here.
Which reminded us of Gene Autry's Cowboy Commandments that he came up with for his radio listeners back in the 30s. It just seems to be a bit in the land.
I would agree.
Yeah. Professor Brent Hathaway, Dean of the College of Business at the University of Wyoming in Laramie. Professor Hathaway, partner, thanks so much.
You bet.
I'm back in the saddle again, out where a friend is a friend.
By the way, Gene Autry's Cowboy Commandments included: the cowboy must be gentle with children, the elderly, and animals, and he must never shoot first, hit a smaller man, or take unfair advantage. I think I'm a cowboy. Back in a few seconds, here now.
Toting my old 44, where you sleep out every night, and the only law is right.
A quarter of the people left homeless by the earthquake in Haiti still don't have shelter. Today, one of America's most prominent architects, along with basketball star Alonzo Mourning and others, will announce his vision for rebuilding Haiti. Miami-based architect and urban planner Andres Duany designed homes for New Orleans after Hurricane Katrina. Now he wants to do the same for Haiti. He joins us now. And Andres, your firm has been working on a housing response since the day of the earthquake. You've said you have to take Haiti's culture into consideration when doing so. So let's just start with the windows. How did Haitian culture influence the windows in your design?
I assumed, given that it's a hot, humid climate, that cross-ventilation would be absolutely necessary. You know, it's what you know as an architect. And so we designed the first house, which had plenty of cross-ventilation. And an anthropologist came up and said, no, in Haiti, people think that spirits come in through the window. And, of course, the answer is not everybody thinks that, but enough people think that you need at least two relationships to window. You need houses that have windows and houses that don't, or preferably houses that can really close hermetically their windows if you do have that belief that spirits fly in and harm you.
We've heard also that you've said that there are people who have different relationships with bedrooms and bathrooms, and you have to take that into consideration. How might that be?
Oh, Lord, yes. For example, there are houses that you look at and you basically say, where's the furniture? There is no furniture. And the reason is that every square foot of the floor is filled with mattresses. So there is a situation in Haiti in which you don't count number of dwellings or number of square feet. You count the number of mattresses. You know, that is actually the currency of building in Haiti.
Well, a couple other things you had to consider. It can't be too complicated a structure because there's a lack of tools and craftsmanship right now in Haiti.
Yeah.
So what did you come up with?
Well, it has to be very forgiving. The workmanship has to be very forgiving. It has to be plus or minus 2 or 3 inches. You know, and most prefabrication is very unforgiving. You know, you basically have to be Swedish, you know, to get it right.
Yeah.
What we came up with is we're trying to address the problem of both earthquakes and hurricanes, which are actually contradictory. Hurricanes love heavy structures, concrete block, etc. But earthquakes knock them down. In fact, virtually all of the injuries were done by the falling down of masonry structures that are hurricane-proof. While the lightweight structures of the hillside, you know, favelas or the hillside informal settlements, although they're terrible, they do terribly in hurricanes, they really didn't fall in the earthquake. So you have two contradictory technologies, and what you need to do is design something which is both lightweight and solid. And we found this material being manufactured in Miami. It's a German patent called Innovida that basically glues up like a hull. It's very lightweight, but it glues up like a hull, you know, like a boat hull.
Right.
And so it can do both. It can sustain both.
Well, we asked the same question of an executive at a company called Durasip. This is a Mississippi company that's producing small fiberglass homes for Haiti. Were you at all worried, given the materials that you're using, about things like chemicals leaking or leaching from the materials?
Well, this particular patent, it's actually used in the interior of airplanes. It doesn't off-gas, and it's fireproof. By the way, I wouldn't turn anything down in Haiti. If this other company or any company has a material that is less than optimal, doesn't matter. It's all necessary. Remember, these units are not air-conditioned. It doesn't matter if they off-gas. The breeze just takes it away. But I think everyone should be there with their ideas as soon as possible. Nothing should be turned down.
So what do they look like? How big are they?
These units are about 160 square feet, but that's because of what fits in a container. And we want to ship four houses as flat packs in each container. So So basically, the houses are 8 by 20, but that's not important. What's important is how many beds do they fit, okay? Mm-hmm. And the house fits 8 beds, and that doesn't include the ones on the floor, which would be an additional 4. Let's just say the 8 dedicated beds, that gives you a density of 590 beds per acre, which is an astonishing number. And that is what we're talking about there. There's, you know, between 1 and 200,000 people that are, you know, outdoors, essentially. It is about beds undercover, but permanently. The tarps are great, but they're not permanent.
They literally look like boxes with a couple of openings here and there, doors, windows that have shutters on them. Some have overhangs that can be raised, it looks like, for protection from the sun or rain. They're so simple, and and there's a beauty in the simplicity, and it doesn't impose any sort of Western architecture or any architecture on
the
Haitians.
Haiti isn't just African; it's African and French. You know, the combination is really quite positive, I think. And the French, of course, are beautiful rationalist people. They're rational, and they have a very good eye for proportion. That box you're looking at is as simple as it can possibly be. It is also very carefully proportioned, you know, with a Western-trained aesthetic eye. Mm. You know, we're not under-designing. You know, designing doesn't cost more. The materials we have to be economical with, but the proportions can be very beautiful. And the house is, you know, as well-proportioned as the house by Philip Johnson in New Canaan, Connecticut. You know, happens to cost a millionth of the amount, but it is as carefully proportioned as his famous glass house.
You designed homes for New Orleans. You described as improvements on the old shotgun shacks that people there loved. And we have pictures of them. They're beautiful to my eye.
Mm-hmm.
But it landed you in the middle of this apparently ongoing architectural argument about urbanism, new urbanism, which you're a part of. You're a leader in the group Congress for the New Urbanism. And I don't know what the other side of it would be, but your critics say that you're trying to create a picture postcard image of the past, that it's too backward-looking. And we should say that you actually did create the set for the actual town for the Truman Show, which some said is a symbol of that sort of picket fence perfection as opposed to some sort of forward-looking modernism. What do you say to that?
Well, since this is a short interview, let me just say a few words. They don't know what the hell they're talking about. You know, this is such a completely irrelevant argument. It is so inaccurate. They've never been to Seaside. Anybody who thinks Seaside is too neat simply hasn't been there.
Seaside, Florida.
Seaside, Florida, which is the one on the Truman Show. Our only objection to these people is they tried to keep us out of New Orleans. The other debate is how much do those modernist houses cost, which is a great deal. You know, you provide too few of them. I don't object to the design. I mean, I'm a good architect. I understand they're good architecture. They're just hideously expensive. And we need to have straightforward, you know, what I call plain old good architecture. You know, not architecture that tries to get into magazines.
That's Andres Duany, co-founder of DPZ architectural firm in Miami. And he's been talking to us about building housing for people who have none in places like New Orleans and Haiti. Andres, thanks so much for talking to us.
Certainly.
Support for Here and Now comes in part from the Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org.
Well, Tiger Woods won't be there, but 500,000 spectators will as the final tournament of professional golf's West Coast Swing gets underway Friday, with PGA golfers teeing up for the Phoenix Open. For the uninitiated, the sport of golf does seem like country clubs in gleaming white shoes and superstars. But hardcore golfers the world over will tell you they consider the game a basic necessity. In Indonesia's Aceh province, a whole village destroyed in the 2004 tsunami is saying what they need most right now is a good set of greens and some long fairways. Chad Bouchard has the story.
Dressed in a canary yellow polo shirt, Indonesian trucking mogul Dedi Sukur whacks a long drive into what appears to be an abandoned lot. The ball lands near construction debris in a patch of pine trees. Not far from the tee, a handful of cows graze on the fairway. Boulders of bleached coral are strewn here and there. Palm tree trunks rise out of the landscape and stop, their tops snapped off like broken matchsticks. But this is no backyard driving range. This is the Sulawesi Golf Course in Indonesia's Aceh province.
I've been so bad today.
Yeah, not so good. Some of the problem is the condition of the course, and the wind is too strong.
Maybe yeah, better for so. Surfing.
Anginnya juga terlalu kencang. Mungkin untuk surfing bagus.
Deddy follows his caddy, Saddam Shamsour, into the rough to find his ball. It turns up next to an old foundation block. Lucky for Deddy, house rules allow players to move their ball within a one-club radius to get clear of the extra hazards. Saddam says playing on this course takes patience and a forgiving disposition.
You can't really push. You have to stay calm and just play.
Deddy may not be having a good day, but this is still his favorite spot to play golf. Squeezed between a horseshoe of jungle-topped mountains and pristine beaches, the course features stunning views. Suluwa may be in rough shape now, but once it was an 18-hole oasis that attracted jet-setters and professional talent from all over Asia. The greens were immaculate, and every hole boasted a small shelter where golfers could rest in the shade. That all changed instantly on December 26, 2004, when a 100-foot-high wall of water slammed into the coast of Aceh. Caddy Mohammed Jamal remembers how the tsunami left behind a wasteland strewn with debris, sand, and hundreds of bodies.
Everything was destroyed. Before, the facilities were nice, every hole had a shelter. Now, you can't even tell.
The tsunami wiped whole villages off the map. It killed 160,000 people in Aceh province alone. The population here in Lokna village dropped from 15,000 to about 400. When it lost the golf course, the village lost a major source of income. Suluwa had supported scores of greenskeepers, parking attendants, small food vendors and waiters, as well as about 200 full-time caddies like Jamal and Saddam. At a makeshift caddy shack at the edge of the course, a couple dozen caddies play a game of dominoes and wait for players. Greenskeeper Jamil says restoring the course at first seemed like an impossible task.
We went to the golf course and looked at the ruins. It seemed like it could never be fixed because there was a lot of debris, a lot of fallen trees. We wondered, how are we going to fix it? We have to fix it. We have to bring it back. Then we made a plan to clean it up.
Over the last couple of years, the caddies have worked by hand, clearing away the wreckage of boats, houses, fishing nets, furniture, and other items carried here by the tsunami. They've managed to create 9 playable holes with crude miniature greens. Some of the players have come back, mostly out of loyalty. Jamil is now the head of the pool of about 50 remaining caddies who are only able to get part-time work on the course. He says the course is simply too important to give up.
It's responsible for so much of what I have. Family, children, school, my house. I built my house with money from this golf course. It means everything.
Many of these caddies started hanging around the golf course nearly as soon as they could walk. I talk with Saddam at his home over Achenese coffee served in port glasses and strong enough to curl your hair. His house is one of scores of concrete clones built here after the tsunami with aid from Saudi Arabia. He recalls collecting golf balls on the course when he was a kid and selling them to players for $1 per pack of 4.
Then one day, one of the caddies quit because one of his players was a little stingy, so I got hired. He went professional and I was his full-time caddy. I lived at his house.
Those glory days are over now. He says after the tsunami, times were desperate. Work was nearly impossible to find in the aftermath.
I bought a motorcycle pedicab to haul stuff like wood and cement. I worked like that for a while. When I would make a little money, I'd give it to my wife. But then I got sick and sold it.
The course isn't anywhere near where it used to be, and neither is his income. Still, Saddam says his 3-year-old son is likely to take up the family profession.
It's up to him, but if the father is a caddy, the son becomes a caddy too, right? He already plays golf with sticks in the yard.
By the time his son grows up, he hopes Suluwa will be a fully functional 18-hole course again, drawing pro golfers and wealthy hobbyists as a stop on the Asian tour. Back out on the course, the wind has picked up and most players have gone for the day. A few caddies play a quick round. They pause for a snack between holes at a small fruit stand on the course that overlooks the ocean. Vendor Reti Marina chops open a fresh coconut with a machete. The mother of five says she makes about $5 a day, a little more on weekends when the course is busiest. One of her children works as a caddy.
Caddies have a good future. They get to know important people like police or public servants and often get jobs through those connections. Many caddies become successful.
But Rina's dreams for herself are more humble. She says she just wants more players to come back so she can make a good living again.